Okay, we are in Matthew chapter 4. I didn't put the chapter. I think it's 5. Somebody go to Matthew chapter 5 and tell me if that's where the Beatitudes start. It is, right? Okay. I knew that. I had all the verses. I didn't have the chapter. So we're starting now on a series of, I think it's 3 chapters at least, maybe part of the next, that is overall combined, kind of referred to as Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. It's this section of Matthew where it appears that many of the teachings of Jesus are collected all together. I don't know that this is a transcription of one message that he gave, or it's a collection of several put together. Don't know. Certainly, it as a whole, it represents a lot of the content of Jesus' teaching. It's a fun section. It starts with a set of verses that have collectively become to be known the Beatitudes. I don't really know what a Beatitude is, and I don't know why they're called Beatitudes. But I did spend some time trying to think of what are they? What is this list of verses? We're going to read them in a minute. And I'll tell you what I think they mean as a collection. And so let's just start out. We're going to read the first 16 verses or so of this chapter, and then we'll discuss it. And seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain where he was, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." I'm going to kind of take these two pieces backwards. I'm going to start out with the second part about being salt and light. And just talk about this to begin with. These are things which Jesus is saying stand out in the world. And it is that we are to be something which is unique. And it's because of us that these things he's teaching are not lost in our world. He just listed all of these attitudes and characteristics, way that people can be in the first verses here. And then he talks about how we are the salt of the earth. And he's saying that these are the kind of things which make the world a brighter and a better place. And if they are lost on the people who are God's people, then where are they going to be found? We are empowered to stand as the lighthouses and as the salt dispensers of God, if you will, and to show everyone what these honorable virtues are like. Let me ask you a question. What makes salt salt? It's a crystal that tastes like salt. If it doesn't taste like salt, what is it? if it tastes like sugar, then if it doesn't have any taste, then what is it? Garbage. Garbage. Yeah. It's like sand, right? It's just like, it's nothing. It's just a crystal that doesn't taste like anything. So what's that good for? Nothing, really. They said you may as well throw that out on the road with the rest of the sand. If we're like salt, well, the rest of the world is like salt that doesn't have any flavor. If we don't have any flavor, then what are we good for? Nothing. So our identity, our purpose in this whole experience is to be different and to taste like salt. And the stuff we just got done reading, and we're going to read again and talk about, is what salt looks like. If we're light, and if you have a light bulb and it doesn't shine light anymore, what's it good for? Nothing, really. You can't even make a doorstop out of it because it's round, right? It doesn't hold the books up. Doesn't really do anything. It's not particularly pretty. It's just a dead light bulb. If we are supposed to be shining the light of Christ to our world and we've lost our light, then what are we good for? Not really good for anything. And again, our identity, our who we are, our view of why we're here should be connected to us shining the light of Christ to the world around us, to the people around us. That's why I think all of these things that we're going to go back and look at again matter, because it answers, it's part of the answer to the question, what does salt taste like? What does light look like? It looks like these things. And as far as what is a beatitude, okay, again, I don't know what that word means, but it appears to me that these are attitudes, that is perspectives, ways of looking at yourself and your world that God blesses. There are ways of looking at your life, ways of looking at your world and how you can impact it that God will bless you for. He wants you to focus on looking at life that way. And this is a list of them. I'm just going to start off on the first one. It says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Another word for that maybe is the word humble. And sometimes it's translated that way. That blessed are the humble. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Our world doesn't seem to value humble very much. Like so many of these characteristics that are in this list, our world doesn't openly say that they value them. But somewhere in their heart, when they see somebody that really has it, they can't help but honor them for it. They still recognize it, but they don't. You won't hear people say very much how much that they honor it. Personally, I think one of the reasons for this, when you look at how the world treats humility, is they're skeptical. When they see someone that appears to be humble, they've been tricked by it so many times. They've seen fake humility so many times that they've gotten skeptical that the real thing really exists. And it's people like us who really stand on who Christ is and not who we are, who can show them a deep and a real humility that goes all the way down to the core of what we are. And that is one of the things that we're here for. Show them that the real thing really still exists. What does it mean? What does humble mean? Well, it's a healthy and an appropriate and accurate way of looking at yourself. It's a attitude which doesn't seek for yourself, but seeks to build up others. It's a attitude of service, of living your life for the purpose of serving others. Now, Satan has a counterfeit for this. And that is, by the counterfeit, I mean if someone appears to be getting too close to real humility, he tries to push them over into other things. And he tries to counterfeit it with things like the I am a worm attitude. The I'm really not worth anything. I'm really, you know, a person that has no self-worth and no self-respect. And he tries to counterfeit that as humble. That's really what humble is. It's not really what humble is. Humble is having an appropriate and a healthy view of yourself, which allows you to spend your life serving other people. Opposite of humble is pride. There you go. That helps us a little more to understand what humble is. Humble is the opposite of pride. And the Bible tells us we should avoid pride in our life. Jesus demonstrated humility in his life. He demonstrated humility, say, by, we were talking about him being baptized by John the Baptist a week or two ago. When Jesus goes to John the Baptist, who is his relative and the prophet who's coming before him, the purpose in John's life is to be the one that announces to the world that Jesus is here. But Jesus, rather than taking the scene himself, comes to John and says, I need to be baptized by you like you're baptizing everybody else. He demonstrated humility by the way that he did that. He demonstrated humility by washing the disciples' feet. And showing them that how Jesus could use his position for the purpose of serving them. And then he challenged them to treat each other in the same way. Jesus shows humility in the Garden of Gethsemane when he's praying to the Father. And he's asking the Father, basically, if there's another way to do this, I'd like to do it another way. Nevertheless, he says at the end, nevertheless, what you want, not what I want. This is a demonstration in Jesus' life of what humility looks like. What does it look like? It looks like I decide to consider your good above mine. I decide that's the way that I'm going to live my life, is to dedicate myself into serving you. We say things like this, that I'm going to live my life for the purpose of serving others. But often it's just, for us, just words. And I'm challenging this morning to look at it more deeply, and to look at your life more deeply, and that Jesus has challenged us in this passage to live our life with a real humility and a serving attitude towards others. And that when we do, our life is actually more satisfying when we live our life for the purpose of serving others than when we live our life for the purpose of serving ourselves. So, blessed are the humble, poor in spirit. Second is, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. I thought about this one a lot. I thought, why is this one here? First thing that I take away from all of these in this list is they're all ways that we look at things. They're not circumstances. There are circumstances which would lead us to mourn, but those circumstances could lead us to have a variety of different reactions. Let me illustrate. There's circumstances such as we lose a spouse, a parent loses a child. A child loses their father or mother. There's a dear friend that dies. Or we're rejected by someone who was very close to us. Someone that we know well and that we love moves away. There's some tragedy that comes in our life which leaves us separated from someone who was dear to us. The reaction can be mourning, grieving. It can be a number of other things, like anger. It can be bitterness. It could be unforgiveness. It could be building a wall of separation between yourself and the world and trying to harden yourself. There are times when God's heart is grieved or is sorrowful for something that happened. And if our heart lines up with his heart, then we're both grieving. Do you see what I mean by that? We're both mourning. When a young child loses their father to an accident or some terrible tragedy, God grieves for that loss. When the child grieves also, then the promise is God comforts. Do you see that? Blessed are those that mourn, for they will be comforted. There are times when the right reaction to what we're experiencing is to mourn. or is to grieve. And when we find ourselves in those circumstances, we can look to God and ought to look to God for comfort because that's his promise in those times. Because when our heart is lining up with his heart, we can find hope in the promise that he will be close to us. This should bring hope to us because always, no matter what happens, God will be there to calm and to comfort our spirit. He's the one that brings that eternal perspective and that significance and the real relief in times of sorrow. I actually don't think that it's trite or that it's wishful thinking to talk to someone who's going through a tragedy and to say, God will comfort you. God will bring you a peace in your heart, because I think it's a promise. And this passage is where we get it from. In times of difficulty and tragedy, Satan tries to push people off the road into things that look a little like mourning, but are really something different. Satan, if people get too close to the right thing, he tries to push them into his counterfeit. One of them is hopelessness. There's nothing you could have done. There's nothing you can ever do. You are completely at the mercy of a really cruel world. This is Satan's lie. It's one of the lies he gives. He comes to people in moments of tragedy and convinces them. He says, I can make this kind of thing happen to you whenever I want, because you are at the mercy of me, the tragedy maker. You're an out of control world. It's not true. That's one of the devil's lies, and he's feeding you hopelessness. But that's not what God promises in the times of grief. What he promises is comfort. And the devil tries to feed hopelessness instead. Another counterfeit he tries to get people to fall into is bitterness. Rather than grieving during the loss and taking it to God and exchanging it for his comfort, Satan will manipulate it into a steaming sort of simmering anger and tries to convince him to focusing on the injustice, and it starts to grow into an overwhelming, consuming bitterness. He would love that to be the result rather than a godly grieving, which results in comfort and then the strength to move on. Grieving and mourning is the opposite of that great ecstatic joy you feel when you have an unexpected blessing. Grieving and mourning is this deep sense of sadness we have over an unexpected hardship. Jesus grieved in his life. Do you remember the story of him weeping over Jerusalem? It was before he went in, near the end of his life. He knew what was going to happen to him. He knew how they were going to treat him, how they were going to reject him. But rather than looking some 30 years ahead in the future and saying, yeah, you're going to get yours. Remember, the entire city was dismantled 30 years later. Rather than finding happiness in knowing that they were going to get theirs, Jesus actually mourned and he wept over the city. You're going to do all this to me, yes, but I'm sad for you because your end is going to be a lot worse than mine. Jesus demonstrated grieving by when he was moved to compassion by the crowds that were all gathering around them. He said things like, they're sheep without a shepherd. And he wanted his disciples to go and minister to them and to feed them. He grieved when Lazarus died before he rose from the dead. And Jesus mourned and grieved on the cross. Do you remember this statement? He said, "Why, Father, why have you forsaken me?" He had this grieving in his heart because of the separation of the relationship between him and Father, which had always been there. So Jesus went through grieving and mourning in his life. So what does this look like? The godly way of handling this. It looks like bringing your sadness and grief to God in an attitude of worship and being willing to exchange it for his comfort. Because that's what he promises us. Bringing our sadness and grief to God in an attitude of worship and faith and exchanging it for his comfort. Don't hold on to the sadness and Because there is sometimes a fake comfort in holding on to this sad and hard situation. We bring it to God, exchange it. It's like this picture. We come to God with our bag of sad things. And we come to Him in a time of worship. We come to Him in His presence, and we lay the thing down and we open it up. And yeah, here's this old stuff that I'm grieving over, and that's been such a hard thing. Here's my broken relationship with a child. Here's my dream that I had that didn't come. Here's my dead cat. It's still there. My dead cat. And all of the things that I'm grieving over in my life. And I meet with God, and he holds me in His arms spiritually, and He comforts me, and He soothes my heart. And I go and I pick the thing up again, fling it over the shoulder, and go off with it. And what was the purpose of all of that? I mean, I think God is sitting there saying, there's a dead cat in there. You're carrying around with you, and every time you get around other people, the smell of the dead cat is so bad it makes their eyes water. You're spreading grief wherever you go because you have this horrible stinking thing that you carry around and you won't let it go. When you bring it to God in that time of exchange, leave it there and let Him, when He says, would you like me to get rid of this for you? Yes, you can take that. Please dispose of it. And let him take it away. And what that looks like very practically is those things which had been so frequently coming to your mind that reminded you of the pain, when they come back, just put them out. Because you already exchanged that one. He already healed you of it. Doesn't mean the devil won't try to remind you of that thing that made you sad before, but you can remind him that I already got comforted for that. It's already done. And I'm moving on now that I've received what God gave for me. Blessed are the meek. The meek. That's a word we don't use so much anymore. For they shall inherit the earth. What does this mean? I looked up the meaning of the Greek word that's used here. It says it's a mildness of disposition and a gentleness of spirit. It's something which comes out of humility. The best that I understand this word is it's a set of actions which rise naturally out of an attitude of humility. It's a word for dedicating your life for the good of someone else and not focusing on what dishonor you might have received yourself or what disappointing thing other people might have done to you, but instead focusing your objective on blessing others and making the world a good place for them. In one of the definitions I read, it included this phrase, enduring injury with patience and without resentment. Meekness includes a way of handling offense that doesn't hold on to it, that easily forgives and easily endures injury. So I think it represents a lifestyle where my goal is to bless you, to make you successful, to make you healthy, and to make you happy. And I'm so dedicated to that that I'm willing to commit myself and my life to that purpose. What is the promise for people who have this attitude? Do you remember that one? They will inherit the earth. They become part of the ruling class. Personally, I think this is not just strictly in this current age that Jesus is referring to here. I think this is also referring to in the age to come, when Jesus and all of us are ruling, and that these are the people who are going to rule. Why would these people be the ones that are going to rule? It's because Jesus is no fool. He wants people who are ruling others to be the ones that have willing to dedicate their life for the benefit of those they're ruling. So like you would want the perfect king to be, one that would dedicate himself to the good of his subjects. That's a picture of what meekness is. Satan's counterfeit. Satan tries to counterfeit meekness by pushing some kind of penitent or self-destructive self-denial that ends up looking like I'm not really worth anything. Meekness is really not an attitude of self, of hating yourself or of not understanding or recognizing your own value. It is a attitude of recognizing the great value of the people that are around you and being willing to dedicate yourself and what you have to their benefit. Opposite of meekness is selfishness, self-absorption. Someone who only thinks of themselves or is power hungry. That is, in the sense of collecting influence for themselves, for their own selfish purposes. Jesus demonstrated meekness in his own death on the cross. Jesus was preferring us to what would bring him honor. His death for us on the cross was a demonstration, one of the biggest demonstrations of meekness. What does it look like? What does meekness look like? It looks like when I get up in the morning, I think of how I can make someone else's day great. Is that the first thing you think of when you get up in the morning? Usually it's coffee, and then it's breakfast, and then it's, why do I have to get up so early? And meekness, I think, is a intentional attitude that I am going to think of how I can make someone else's day wonderful today. How can I do that with someone that is in my life, that's in my world? It's a finding happiness and fulfillment in making their life good. I'm going to do something extra around the house today. I'm going to like wash the dishes for no apparent reason. I'm going to clean my room randomly. That will scare mom. I'm going to go to mom and say something like, is there anything that I could do for you? That would scare her too. Or are you going to go and say, how is your day going? She won't even know what to say to that. I'm going to ask myself, what do my long-term plans for my life, how are they going to benefit the other people in my life? I'm going to do things like notice and care about the condition of the people that I influence. Am I in a supervising position at work? Am I teaching at work? Am I running meetings at work? And that I'm doing, how can I, in those times and places where I have influence, make the world a better place, make the day a better day for the people that I am influencing? Remember that it's preparation for ruling. How would I prepare myself to be one who is actually ruling and being thinking constantly about the benefit of others? Hungry. The next attitude is hungry. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. I think this hunger, it's obviously a spiritual term. That this hunger is having a strong and constant desire to know God better, to understand his ways. His ways are righteousness, right? To understand how he does things, to understand how he thinks about things, how he feels about things. And I think this hunger is something which drives us to action. It's not simply a deep, passionate feeling. It's not just that I want to have a better relationship with God. It's not just that I wish I had a better relationship with God. It's that I am hungry for it, bad enough that I'm going to do what it takes to get there. Let me just give you a little trivial story to illustrate what I mean. Let us say that there's a husband who's always saying, I really, really want to have a closer, deeper connection with my wife. I really want to spend more time with you, to do more things together. And the wife comes one day and says, hey, tomorrow I was going to do this thing and it's gone off my calendar now. And I have all day. I'm going to dedicate it to us. And the husband says, okay, wow. I got a trip to the hardware store in the morning, first thing in the morning, and then I'm mowing the lawn. And then I got one of the guys I'm going to meet for lunch. And then, like, we could do 2 hours at the gym before the football game starts at 4. How about that? Is this husband hungry for deeper connection relationship with his wife? No. He might wish he had a better connection with his wife and believe that he probably does. He might say that he is, but he isn't really hungry. What would he do if he was really hungry? He would clear the calendar and say, okay, what time does your day start, honey? We'll start then. And we'll do whatever we want to do. Being hungry for knowing God deeper means that I'm going to open up all the possibilities to him. When he's ready to talk, I'm going to be ready to listen. When he wants me to do something, I'm going to be ready and willing to do it, whether it's in line with what I had planned or it's not. It means that I'm willing to put him at the top of the list whenever I sense that I know what he wants. And when I don't sense that I know what he wants, I'm going to keep digging in until I do. It means that I won't let stand this feeling that I have a cold or a distant relationship with God. That when I feel that, I'm going to keep pushing in until I don't feel it anymore because I'm not willing to let that feeling stay. I'm going to keep doing what I know to do until that goes away. Satan has counterfeits to this hunger. He tries tirelessly to steer us away from this one because he knows that a real spiritual hunger is just death to all of his plans. He tries to steer us away from it into things like legalism. If I could only do right enough, then God would want to be with me. Then God would want to, what is it that the blessing is, by the way, on this one? Blessed are those, they'll be filled. So maybe if I could just do right enough that he would fill me. That's a legalism. What is it that he says that he wants you to have is a hunger and thirst for the righteousness. He's after something that's an attitude that's driving us to action. He's not after a series of things that we do and we don't do. He's after a person who is willing to put everything aside to go after understanding God, to go after knowing God, to go after him, what he really is. And that's a different thing than someone who's looking for what I need to do and not do so that he will love me. Satan tries to push us off into penance. If I could only prove my love by some kind of difficult thing that I would do, I will deprive myself of something. I will do something very difficult to prove it. And then maybe he will take notice and he will fill me. Or Satan pushes us off into wishing, hoping, and dreaming about a deeper relationship with God. And we wish and we hope and we dream and we whine and we complain and we stew and we get jealous when you see other people get blessed. But we never do anything. Satan likes to push us off into that as well. A hunger and thirst for righteousness is the opposite of apathy towards spiritual things. I'm saved. I'm okay to the end. I'm good. Not really being interested or digging into spiritual things at all. It is an opposite of a life which is absorbed in the distractions of the worldly desires of around us. And opposite of a person that doesn't think about spiritual things in the course of their normal day. Jesus demonstrated a hunger and thirst for righteousness. we talked about this, he spent time fasting before this time of temptation came. He spent these 40 days of prayer and fasting to dig into his relationship, to dig into the Father and dig into things spiritually, so that he would be ready when those times came. We see Jesus very connected with the heart of God when he has this spontaneous frustration with those people in the temple that had set up their booths to sell stuff. He was connected. He had a zeal for righteousness. When he saw this stuff going on right there in the temple, he was just instantly frustrated, because this was not what worship was all about. And we see this reaction from him, I think, as an example of his hunger and his thirst, his drive, passion for true righteousness and the way that God is. What does it look like? What does hunger and thirst for righteousness look like? I think it's a continual pressing in spiritually towards the person of God. Pressing in, I want to know you better. I want to see what you see. I want to hear like you hear. I want to feel like you feel. Remember, we talked about a couple weeks ago, what's the most important relationship in your life? And what are you going to do this year to feed it? Remember, we were talking about that. It's a lifestyle of nurturing that relationship and putting it as a priority. It's a being willing to stop anything I'm doing if I feel that God is telling me to, or to start anything that I feel that he's telling me to. It is my willingness to put God's will above any desire or inclination that I have, or any, quote, need that seems to be presenting itself to me from inside of me. That is, I'm willing to silence voices that are coming inside of me by telling them no. Remember, we've talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Silence those voices inside of me that are just coming from me, that are not really what I need, by telling them no, and to silence the voices of people around me by going to the secret place if I need to, so that I can focus on this time with God and on this relationship. We talked about all of that. Almost done. I think there's two left. Merciful. Blessed are the merciful, for they will obtain mercy. What is merciful? It means that in my heart, I hope for your improvement. I hope for your good. I hope that you will change the wrong views that you have, to change the things that drive you to do wrong. I really want for you repentance and redemption, rather than that you would get what you deserve because of what you did. It's a merciful attitude, as I would rather you become a better person than to get what you deserve. The promise for the merciful, they will get mercy. That's a good one. Satan has many counterfeits, things that look like mercy, but that really aren't. One of the most common is the champion for injustice. Let the brutal person win and the victim put up with it. It's not really mercy to defend the. Let me back up a little bit. The merciful attitude to me is that you're always wanting for the redemption and the repentance of the person who's done the wrong. I want them to become a better person. There is a fake kind of mercy, which looks like it wasn't their fault. It's because of the way they were raised. It was because of the people they were hanging around. It was because of this or that happened in their life. So I want to relieve the guilt from that person that did this terrible thing. I don't really want to relieve the guilt from them. I want them to understand what they did wrong, to be transformed, to be renewed, to be redeemed, and become a better person. That's what I want for them. You see the difference and the counterfeit that the devil tries to throw in there to confuse things. Many other, I'm sure, counterfeits of mercy. Being merciful is the opposite of being vindictive. The opposite of hating those who have done evil and holding on to that. It's the opposite of brutally wishing harm to come to them without mercy. Jesus demonstrated mercy in his life. These are some of the easiest ones to remember. Jesus demonstrated mercy with the woman who was caught in adultery. He wanted for her to become right. He wanted her to come round and to live a good life. Go and don't sin anymore. That's what he wanted for her. He had mercy on Peter when he denied Christ. Jesus didn't want Peter to be separated from him forever. Jesus wanted Peter to be one of the leaders in the church that was going to start after he was gone. He wanted to redeem Peter and to draw him back, and that's what he did when he talked to him after he had denied him. Jesus had mercy on the woman at the well, and he was talking to her about her life and what she'd done and how he reached out to her. Even his reaction to us, to die for us rather than wanting for us what we deserve. He wanted that we could be redeemed and be restored in a relationship with God. The last one is, blessed are the pure in heart. I'm just going to call this the honesty. It's translated that way in some of the other translations. But those that are pure in heart, for they shall see God. It's, what is it? It's a transparency. It's an openness. It's a clear, clean, understandable motives that are good. One that has a pure heart has good motives. You are what you appear to be, without any guile, without any deception, without secrets. This is what we all love to be, right? And the promise is, for those people, they will see God. God values open and honesty, the pure heart of integrity. And those who are most like that are those that walk the closest with him. Satan has counterfeits to them, I'm sure. But to be honest, when I thought about it, I wasn't really sure how you can counterfeit an open and honest person of integrity. So, okay, I left that one blank. What is Satan's counterfeit to the one who is open and honest and no secrets and a person of integrity? Well, he just tries to convince you that they are when you aren't. But if you are, you are. And there's not really two ways to be that. It is the opposite of being deceptive. It is the opposite of being cagey or secretive. It's the opposite of being manipulative. We have this word duplicitous. I'm going to present to you one picture of me that I want you to believe, but inside I have a different me that I don't want you to see. This is duplicitous. This is a person who's lacking in integrity, lacking in honesty. They're not a person that has a pure heart. Jesus demonstrated pure in heart. It's innocence and openness many times in his life. One easy example is when he was the young boy at the temple, and he was talking with the other leaders, and mom and dad went home, and on their way home, and then they came back, they find him, and his answer was, didn't you know that I would be here? This open honesty, wasn't trying to hide anything. He's a person of integrity, and he demonstrated that even as a young boy. Jesus, I think, demonstrated his open heart when he talks to Peter, and he just asks him things like, who's everybody saying that I am? Just, you know, very open and honest question to Peter. What is everybody saying? And then he asks, well, what do you say I am? And he's opening himself vulnerable to his close friends and just inviting them to be honest with him as he is being open with them. What does it look like for us? It's to be a person of integrity. It's to be what we say we are. To actually live out what we say that we believe. Is we don't try to deceive people. We don't try to make ourselves look better than we are. We try to make ourselves be better than we are. It's being honest with ourselves and being honest with others. There is one more, the peacemakers, which I'm going to skip because we're running late. Just to wrap it up. We are the salt of the earth. We're the light of the world. We're not like everyone else. We're here for the purpose of being different, for the purpose of standing out, for the purpose of showing that there are some really good qualities. There are some good perspective. There are some good things in the world that God has to offer, and we are the demonstration of it. And this list of things that he gives us at the beginning of Matthew chapter 5 is just part of it. And it is our role to be as much like Christ as we can and to put as many of these things in our life as we can. And in that process, we will give the people around us hope that there really is something that is good. If we don't have it, then we're like salt that doesn't have any saltiness. It's just good enough for throwing on the road, or a light bulb that doesn't have any light. It is our identity. These things that we were just talking about, it is our purpose in life. It is who we are, and it's why we're here. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your transforming work in every one of us. And I thank you that all of these things you listed here are the things that you are developing and growing in us. And I pray that you would enable each one of us to come more and more like you in these ways. I pray you would bless our time of fellowship this afternoon and the food that we will eat, that it will be a blessed time together. In Jesus' name, amen.